now I'll had a chance to read the Coase article, and I'll be saying more about it later in today's class, but let me just start by asking whether there were particular things that you found puzzling or couldn't follow or understand or confused you that you'd like cleared up at this point. Anybody? Yes? No? The one thing that I noticed, which occurred to me would be transparent to an economist but not to somebody else, is the way he keeps talking about factors of production. And what he's really saying is that if you're thinking about what's the benefit of running an extra train or of planting grain or anything else, the benefit isn't the value of the services produced by the train, it's the value of the services minus the cost of producing them. And what's the cost of producing them? It's the value of the inputs, the factors of production, that are being used to produce them. And that's, I think, a mistake that non-economists talking about sort of general issues very often make, that you say, well, the auto industry is a $50 billion industry or whatever it is, and treat that as though it means that if it disappeared, we'd be $50 billion a year worse off. And that's just wrong, because if the industry disappeared, there'd be a bunch of people who could do something else, a whole bunch of buildings that could be used for something else, a bunch of iron ore could go to produce steel for making buildings instead of cars and so forth. And you have to net out that in figuring out what the gain is. And the economists use these terms, producer surplus and consumer surplus, as a measure of the net benefit from producing and selling something or from buying and consuming something, and it's not the value of the thing, it's the value of the thing net of the costs. Anyway, I've got the spaghetti diagram up because that was in a certain sense the sort of end point of a large chunk of what we did Tuesday. Do people think they understand what all of this is?
I have a question about the rabbit analogy. I wasn't sure.
His rabbit, yes.
What he was trying to, what the purpose of that analogy was.
He's looking at rabbits. On the one hand, could be kept as a source of meat and fur, but since they were normally kept, at least back in the Middle Ages, I don't know if it's true still, not inside a fenced enclosure, but by making, I don't know how they did it, put out food or something, but basically having an area where the rabbits lived as wild animals and then trapping them some number. And one result is the rabbits would cross the boundary and go into your neighbor's field and eat his corn. And the question is, what's the legal status of that? And the common law had made a distinction between damage done by trespasses due to wild animals that started on your property and damage done by things like flooding from your reservoir breaking or smoke from your chimney or stink from your tannery or something. And Coase has got his doubts that distinction made any sense, but it was in fact the distinction in the common law. And it looks as though somehow the court, in whatever it was, the 14th century or so when the original case was decided, seemed to be arguing that because the neighbor, if he liked, could kill the rabbits himself and eat them, therefore somehow their trespass wasn't attributable to the guy whose property they were coming from. And Coase is taking that as a case of the common law trying to deal with externalities, possibly getting it wrong, it's not entirely clear. But considering the issue, and that Pigou has been talking as though in the absence of government action, people wouldn't be liable for the damage they did, and Coase is saying, wait a minute, in the railroad case, you've got it exactly backwards. In the absence of specific government action, they were liable. It was only because the railroads were operating under statutory authority, because Parliament had passed a law saying you are authorized to run this railroad and not be liable for sparks, that they weren't liable, and that the rabbit case suggests sometimes the common law makes you liable, sometimes not. It offers possible reasons. It's not clear if they're good reasons or not. So spaghetti diagram, people understand what we're doing. We're considering different legal rules that you might start with. And for each legal rule you might start with, we're considering four possible outcomes that might be the efficient outcome. And Coase makes this point in discussing his railroad farmer example, that what the efficient outcome isn't something you can determine in advance from saying someone is imposing externalities. You would have to actually know what the costs and benefits of the different alternatives were, because the one rule which says that the railroad is not liable has the undesirable result that the railroad doesn't take account of the costs that it's imposing on the farmer by throwing sparks. The other rule that says the railroad is liable has the undesirable consequence that the farmer doesn't take account of the cost he's imposing on the railroad by choosing to cultivate crops in the places where the sparks are falling. And in, you can imagine, according to how you fiddle the numbers, you can imagine a case where the inefficiency from the first problem was either larger or smaller than the second, therefore a case where one rule or another was better. Is that point clear? That Pigou and people like that were in effect saying, look, here we can show this person isn't taking all costs into account. Make him do it, that finishes it. Coase is saying, no, what we're really considering is not simply what should he do, but which rules should we have? And rules have multiple consequences, and the fact that this rule is better in this way doesn't tell us whether on net it's better or not, to the point he's making there. And I've then gone from Coase's argument, and he doesn't put it in these terms in the essay, to imagining how you would use that if you were constructing a legal system. And the general procedure is we have alternative rules, we have alternative outcomes. In any particular situation, one of these outcomes is best. Given each rule, how would you get to each outcome? And what would keep you from getting to each of the outcomes, what might, how costly would it be, and you could then imagine in a sort of a imaginary full knowledge world where you can really solve these things, you could say for each possible situation, here is the efficient outcome, here are the circumstances determining the transaction costs from each of the rules, how bad is each of the rules? All right, well, this rule is great, you get straight to the right outcome, this rule is pretty bad, you get to the right outcome, you've got to overcome some problem or cost, which you might not do. This one is terrible. Now, sum that over all the possible situations that the rule might ever apply to, each one weighted by its probability, just as if you were a gambler trying to figure out what the right action in chess or bridge, or chess doesn't have probabilities, but in poker or in bridge, if you think about the economist as the equivalent of the bridge player or the poker player, and you're saying, look, in this situation, what should I do? Well, there's a certain probability that this is that he's holding the ace, in which case here's the result. There's a probability that he's holding the ace, different result. What's the probability of each of those? How good or bad are those results? Therefore, which stratagem should I use in playing? How many of you play bridge? Just curious, have played bridge at some point?
I've tried to learn.
How many of you have played poker at some point? All right. I'm just thinking to what extent it sort of seems natural to think in those terms, in the sort of the gambling game approach to an uncertain world, which is you consider something you might do, and you then look at its payoff sort of weighted by the probabilities over all the alternatives. And now what I'm doing here is choosing a legal rule. And it's obviously a lot more complicated than my sort of simplified railroad to farmer example suggests. First, there are more than four possible legal rules, as I pointed out. You could modify a legal rule by saying, well, usually this person is liable, but under these circumstances, someone else is. If you think about negligence rules, for example, which do that sort of thing. But I think this is sort of just complicated enough to show the logic of the problem and simplified enough so you can still see it. And then you could imagine in this case, if you really knew how likely it was over the 50 years during which your legal rule was going to apply, in how many cases there would be in which the efficient thing was a spark arrestor, and how many cases the efficient thing was grain and fires, and how many it was clover, and in each of these cases, how likely is it that there would be a small number of farmers or a large number of farmers, which affects the transaction cost, you could then imagine actually calculating out the expected return, as it were, from each of the possible rules, pick the best one. I think that's a useful way in the abstract of thinking of what we're doing, even though we never know enough to really do it. And as I suggest, we don't know enough, but that gives us some qualitative results. We can say if you change the situation in this way, that makes this rule more attractive than before, and that rule less. And that will help you say, well, maybe we ought to have strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities, which is something we'll come back to much later, and have negligence for ordinary activities. That might be a possible conclusion. I then discuss a fifth rule, namely a tax rather than a liability, which is one in which the railroad has to pay for the fires, but the farmers don't get it. That has the attractive characteristic that now the farmers have an incentive to minimize the damage by planting clover, but I raise the fact that that might have some unattractive results because the railroad might be able to, in effect, bluff the farmers into switching clover and thus keep on throwing sparks, even if the spark arrestor was the cheapest solution. And also, it might give too strong an incentive if the farmers bargain with the railroad to add something in addition to the savings from not paying. So those are all sort of further points. Another possible legal rule that we discussed very briefly is some group decision rule for the farmers, like the case of unitization of oil fields. And you could imagine a legal regime, as we have in many states, where for a particular problem where it's known that something like the public good problem, holdout problem exists, we've got some kind of a group decision rule in which the decision made by two-thirds of the relevant group binds everybody. But that raises other problems, of course, because once you've got a group decision rule, now some members of the group can try to use that rule to benefit themselves at the expense of other members of the group. Then went on to discuss a particular, not the same issue really that we were looking at there, although I guess in a sense I was looking at a property or liability rule for the railroad, in that I was considering both the case where the farmers had a property right not to have their crops burned, they could enjoin the railroad, and the case where they had a liability right, they could only collect damages. But in general, it's adding a useful way of looking at our legal system is to think of, we've got this problem of moving resources, of moving things to their highest valued use. One solution is a property rule. Property rule says somebody owns it, you want it, you think your value is higher than his, make him an offer. And that's the way a lot of stuff is allocated in our society. Alternative rule, liability rule, says you want something that belongs to somebody else, you take it, he sues you, you pay him damages. And to me at least, that on the face of it looks like a worse rule because it's a whole lot more trouble going to court than going into the grocery store and buying something. But you then start thinking about cases like the risk imposed by driving, where what I'm doing is imposing a small probabilistic risk on a huge number of people. There ought to be some restriction on my doing that, and yet it doesn't make sense to say that I've got to get permission from every one of them before doing it. So there, it sounds as though it makes sense. We wait until it actually happens. Almost every time I go out of my driveway, I don't run into anybody. So almost every time, there's no need for any action. Once in 5 years, I run into somebody, and at that point, we know who I ran into, and we can then have the legal procedure go on from there. If you had only liability rights, and a perfect court system were just fine. Anytime I want anything, I take it, assuming that I believe it's worth more to me than the owner. He sues, I pay him, court estimates how much damage I did to him, therefore everything goes to its highest valued use. Does that make sense? If you imagine that at no cost the court can observe who took the car, observe what the cost was to the owner of the car of having it taken, and make the guy who took it pay for it. Sure. Simple enough. With a pure property right system and zero transaction costs, no problem. Anytime I think something's worth more to me than to the owner, I make him an offer, we agree on a price, I get it. That's just fine. And it's worth noting, as you should be obvious by now, especially after reading Coase, that something doesn't have to be a thing. Something could be a right with regard to a thing. And indeed, something always is rights with regard to things, because what we mean when you say you own something is you own certain rights with regard to something. If you own a gun, what sort of rights do you own with regard to that gun? Any guess? What? But what do those property rights consist of? What things can you do with your gun, and what things can't you do with your gun?
Have possession and control.
What? Can you speak a little louder? Sorry.
Possession and control.
Do I have control? I can do anything I like with the gun?
Well,
you sure? What? I can't shoot you with the gun. I can't even, if it's a handgun, take it into this room. I don't think. I'm pretty sure that when I last looked at California law, you weren't allowed to have a handgun. Maybe there are exceptions for police, even unloaded in a locked case within a certain distance of a school. And I think school includes university, though I'm not sure. I think I concluded at one point that I was an inadvertent felon reading the law after having parked my car, you know, in the parking lot or somewhere near here with a handgun locked in the trunk that I had used. This was 10 years ago or something in a shooting range for shooting. So, on the other hand, you do have the right to keep the gun at home. You have the right to go to a shooting range with appropriate restrictions on what you can do depending on the state, shoot that gun. You may have the right to sell the gun to someone else. I'm not sure. That probably depends on the state law, what the restrictions are on transfers of guns and so forth. How about a book? Right, some of you presumably have copies of my book, Law's Order. What rights do you or don't you have with regard to that book? What's the obvious right you don't have?
Reproduction,
right? Because of copyright law. But you have the right to burn it. You've got the right to make markings on it. You've got the right to read it. You've got the right to sell it to someone else. Whole bunch of rights, but not a complete set of rights with regard to the book. And similarly, as I pointed out earlier, if you think about land, our rights with regard to land are really a bundle of rights connected to the land, but you can think of lots of cases where it's not obvious what goes in that bundle because the same right is relevant to adjacent portions of land. To take a real-world example, real-world legal example, let us suppose that my house is built right up against the property line between my property and your property, and you decide to excavate a deep pit just on your side of the property line. What happens? Any guesses?
This is a situation covered by English common law, as I understand it. Let us suppose that here is the property line, here is my very handsome house, and here is your very deep pit. What do you think is likely to occur given the physics of that situation?
My house falls into your pit.
That's right. The ground under here starts falling out, and my house collapses. And the reason you can't legally do that under English common law is that one of the things I own with regard to my property is something called a right of lateral support. A right that you not change the circumstances in such a way that my property slides sideways into yours. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, and we'll discuss more in a later part of the class, if I own surface land in Pennsylvania 50 years ago at least, I didn't automatically own a right of vertical support. That was a separate property right, a separate estate as they put it, and that if I have a nice house sitting in a pretty yard and you own the mineral rights for that same piece of land, which means you can grow coal, you can dig coal from underneath it, and if I didn't take the precaution of making sure that along with the surface right, I also own the support right, if you, the coal miner, own the support right, I have no action against you when my house collapses into your coal mine because you didn't have a legal obligation to support my house. If I do own the support right, then you can still mine the coal, but you've got to leave enough to hold up the surface, and if you don't, you're liable for the damages. So those are all examples. So what does all of this tell us? It tells us that property rules make sense if transaction costs are low, because then it's easy to use mutual agreement to move property to its highest value use. But they make much less sense if transaction costs are very high, as in the case where I need a million people's permission to do something. They also make sense if the litigation costs are high. That is, even if transaction costs are high, if the alternative is even worse, you would prefer property. So that if you imagine a case where it's hard for the court to know my value, whereas my value gets revealed by what offers I reveal, or if when you steal my car, it's going to be hard to find the car and figure out who stole it. Those are all costs that make the litigation alternative work poorly, and those would be all arguments in favor of a property rule. Liability rules work well if you reverse the assumptions, if you assume that transactions are hard to do and that the court can easily measure who did what to whom.
And in real-world cases in between those two, it's in a sense a judgment call as to which of the imperfect alternatives works best. Another alternative that we discussed already in the farmer and railroad case is fines. The advantage of the fine is that the, quote, victim, I say quote because that's a sort of precocean way of thinking of the problem, has an incentive to take precautions because if the event happens, he bears the full cost. On the other hand, if transaction costs are low, we then have the double counting problem that I have both the incentive from the fine and the incentive from your being willing to pay me not to do it, so I might prevent something even if prevention costs were higher than damage done. Everybody follows that sort of, I've been through it before. All right, that's my cost plus bagoo is too much of a good thing. And the final point, which we'll again come back to, is that, so you can imagine, think about traffic accidents. That at the moment, it's mostly covered by a liability system. There are extreme cases. Drunk driving is a criminal offense. But if all I do is step on the brakes a second too late with the result that I skid into your car and damage it, the way we try to keep me from doing that is by your being able to sue me for damages. All right. Suppose we made it a fine system instead. Now, you have an incentive to make sure you're not in a place where I'm likely to skid into you. You have an incentive to buy a car less expensive to fix because you'll have to fix it. So there clearly is some advantage to the fine. But the one very obvious disadvantage is that if you use a fine, now when your car skids into my car, why should I report it? Why should, if the cops don't happen to be there, and they usually aren't, whereas I'm always there, not always there, my car might be parked, but in moving traffic accidents, the victim is always there, the victim observes it, but if the fine goes to the state, it makes a lot more sense for the victim to say to the guy, look, hey, this is going to cost me $150 to fix. Give me $150 and keep it off your record. All right? Could even do that now, of course. But there's a stronger argument if I know that I'm not going to get the money from the liability, the state's going to get it instead. Right. So one way of putting it, in fact, is that you could think of tort liability either as a... Really, you could think of it as three different things. You could think of it as a Pigouvian tax, an incentive not to do things. You could think of it as a form of insurance, a way of making the victim whole. And you could think of it as a bounty for reporting the accident. The payment, reporting, and prosecuting the accident, in effect. You can think of a tort system as a private law enforcement system, a private system which instead of having a district attorney, you have people like you who are ordinary attorneys working for private parties, and they do the work of the DA. That is, they say, look, you're guilty and we'll prove it in a tort case rather than a criminal. So in a sense, it's sort of an intriguing feature of tort law is that it can be seen in these three different ways, but that, as we will see later, has the inconvenient fact that there's no reason to assume, if you're designing tort law, that the right rule for one of those three purposes is the same as the right rule for the other. So that it might be that if you wanted insurance, you would want to fully compensate, and if you wanted Pigouvian tax, you would want to fully compensate, but that might be much too high a bounty. Which is why we worry about things like class actions and punitive damages and things where we're afraid that we're creating an incentive for people to engage in litigation just to make money, not to prevent problems. Now, in our system at the moment, of course, there's another reason to report the accident, and that's to your insurance company. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but many years ago when we lived in Chicago, we had a burglary. And it was reasonably clear, talking to the policewoman who came when we reported it, that she assumed that the only reason we were bothering to report it was in order to have the paperwork to make an insurance claim. My vague memory is that we weren't actually insured at the time, so it wasn't the case. The way she put it, I'm pretty sure she was the one who made the comment that, as a practical matter, criminalizing marijuana meant decriminalizing burglary, because the police had limited resources, and investigating all the burglaries just wasn't going to happen. And didn't happen, I think. So anyway. Now, one of the sort of details that comes out of all of this discussion is that what the right rule is depends in large part on fact-specific information. Is this a situation where typically transaction costs are high or low? Is this a situation where usually it is or isn't efficient to put on a spark arrestor, things like that? And that might be an argument both for freedom of contract and for industry arbitration, That is freedom of contract, in the sense that the contracting parties in advance know the facts of this particular situation. They therefore know it more, at least, about what will go wrong than a legislature would that was making a rule to cover everybody. And therefore, they can say, well, if it goes wrong in the following way, and that results in my losing a bunch of money, you are or not liable. It's also an argument for the kind of system which is very common, where what we think of as legal disputes actually never get to the courts, because the parties agree either in advance or after the fact to some form of private arbitration, and very often for intra-industry disputes, there will be a well-established arbitration system where the arbitrators are not judges, but people, maybe retired people from the industry, who are experts on the details of that industry and therefore can do a much better job of understanding what happened in the particular dispute. So there's a sense in which the workability of general rules partly depends on situations where what the right rule is doesn't depend on the detailed facts of the situation. All right, let me stop there on what I'm doing, and let's go to the Coase article. And I want to claim, and I hope I'm right, maybe I'm not, that it really is an article that somebody who isn't trained in economics can read. The references to factors of production was one counterexample that occurred to me, and it may be that I'm sufficiently used to thinking like an economist that it's not obvious to me where he's saying things that are more obvious to me than they are to the average layman. But the basic argument, as you can see, is that the problem is jointly caused. That's one part of it. And that as long as transaction costs are low, the parties can bargain to the efficient outcome, and usually the same efficient outcome, whoever has the rights, basically. So he runs through initially his farmer and cattleman example, where he shows that the outcome, which is what crops are grown where, how many cattle the cattleman keeps, doesn't depend on whether or not the rancher is liable for damage done by his cattle to the farmer's crop, provided transaction costs are low. Are people happy with that argument? Is there something that seemed puzzling to them in that or not? That in the one, under the one rule, adding adding a cow to your herd has a cost because it increases the liability damage you're going to have to pay. Under the other rule, it has a cost because it means you've got to turn down the offer that the farmer made to pay you to keep your herd smaller, basically. Same cost, both of those are equal to the damage done to the farmer. Similarly for building the fence, if you want to do the logic. And one complication, and it's one which is sort of a little disturbing, but seems to be in a zero transaction cost world, he's right, is extortion. That is to say that you could imagine the farmer in the world where the rancher is liable planting crops that aren't really worth planting, that wouldn't be worth planting even if there were no cattle, not in order to collect damages from the rancher, because the damages should still be worse off, but rather in order to get the rancher to pay him to stop planting. If he doesn't plant them, he doesn't have to pay the cost of planting them. So if you imagine a particular area where if he plants crops, it would cost $100 to cultivate the crops, and you get $90 worth of crops out of it. Why would he do that? Because crops there will be trampled by the cattle. That'll do $50 worth of damage. Even after he gets $50 worth of recompense from the rancher, he's still worse off. He's still spending $100 to get $50 from the rancher and $40 selling whatever grain is left. But he's better off if the rancher agrees to pay him $20 a year to not grow the crops there. However, once all of that bargaining is done, it still certainly looks as though you ought to end up with the same outcome. I was repeating what I said earlier here about factors of production here on the slide. Again, this may all be obvious, just in terms of the mechanics of what he's doing. He's imagining a herd of 1, 2, 3, or 4 cows. Total crop loss is increasing with the number of cows for some reason. Marginal crop loss is how much more the crop is lost if you add one more cow. Increasing from 0 to 1, marginal loss is 1. Increasing from 1 to 2, marginal loss is 2, because it goes from 1 to 3. 2 to 3, marginal cost is 3, and so forth. Everybody's familiar with those. Does it make sense to you or not? Yeah. Yes.
In the case of the farmer extorting the rancher.
Yes.
If I'm the rancher and I'm paying $50 a year to to stop the damage of your crop, you come to me and you say, look, pay me $40 a year and I'll stop planting crops.
Yes.
I'm going to make that because I'm not aware that he's losing crops.
That is, you're right that the outcome of that is going to depend in part on the knowledge of the rancher and the farmer. In general, asymmetric information is one of the sources of what we call market failure, which means situations where rational behavior by individuals doesn't produce efficient outcomes, and that's, in effect, goes in along with one of the transaction costs is getting information, as Coase, I think, explicitly includes in his list of transaction costs. But in any case, the critical point is not who pays whom what, but what crops are grown and what animals. So really, in order for Coase's result to be defeated, you need a case where somebody alters his behavior in order to fool someone else into thinking that his costs and benefits are different than they are, in order to get that somebody else to pay him off. I'm sure with a little ingenuity you could construct such a case, but I think we would then say, yeah, but that's a transaction cost. There's a cost in principle. The two people would be better off if the guy stopped doing whatever he's doing and just took a fixed payment, and it's only because the transaction of cost of my admitting that I've been bluffing you, and I'll stop doing the expensive thing if you'll pay me half the amount I was bluffing you out of. That's a mutually beneficial transaction, but it's real hard to make it, because once I admit I've been bluffing you, the bluff doesn't work anymore. Does that make sense? No?
Yeah.
Anyway. But no, I agree. That's one area where you do get complications. And I'm really running through stuff Coase has already done, that if the rancher is liable, if he doesn't build a fence, he's going to increase the herd until the next animal he's thinking about adding would have done at least as much damage as the value to him of that animal, at which point it doesn't pay him to add the animal. Right, that's a simple logic. And the farmer then ignores the damage in deciding how much to plant. This is prior to any transactions, because he's going to be fully compensated. Alternatively, the rancher can say, is the cost of the fence less than the damage I'm going to be paying? If so, let's build the fence. And if you think about it a little more, you say he might even build the fence if the cost is a bit more than the damage he'd be paying, because those damages are for running three cattle, whatever the optimal size of the herd is. Once he builds the fence, he can run four cattle if that's more profitable. All right, so it might be, you can set up the numbers such that he was paying $5 a year in damages. Building and maintaining the fence costs him $6 a year. But it's still worth doing, because when he builds and maintains the fence, he also expands his herd, which wasn't worth doing if he had to pay damages for the extra cow, and that more than covers the difference. Is that?
Yeah.
No. It's sort of a fine point, but it's worth trying to get some of the fine points right. With a fence, marginal cost of damage, assuming that the cost of the fence doesn't depend on the herd size, which it might or might not, depending on whether some fences are broken down by bigger herds or something. So now the marginal cost of damage is zero for an additional steer if you have a fence, so then you add the steers as long as net revenue increases, and you compare the profit of that option with the profit at the no-fence case. If the rancher is not liable, then the farmer will pay the rancher to keep his herd down. Arguments run through the same way. And as we will see much later in the semester, whether or not the rancher is liable is what's referred to as the open range versus closed range distinction in American property law. Bargaining between them. The argument is that if there's some area which, given that you're compensated, you're going to cultivate, but where in fact your profits from cultivating it are less than the compensation, then there's a mutually beneficial deal by which you agree to let it go out of cultivation in exchange for the rancher paying you something which is less than the damages he was paying, but more than the profits that you were making from cultivating. Does that make sense? And I then mentioned the extortion case down below here, in the case where it isn't worth planting, but he might try to plant it for a while in the hope of persuading the rancher to pay him out. If the rancher is not liable, you end up with essentially the same results. Coase on Pigou, it's a good deal of fun. And one of the things I enjoy, partly rereading it, is seeing the degree to which Coase is, I won't quite say he's writing with his tongue in cheek, but he's being sort of mildly and subtly sarcastic along with making his serious points. But in particular, that here Pigou is taking it for granted that having the railroad not liable is the state of nature. And I think Coase would really say there is no state of nature, no such thing. All of these are proceeding with some set of property rules. And you could imagine a system where the set of property rules didn't come from the state. The set of property rules could be a set of private norms. It could be religious rules. Everybody, you can imagine, but there's some set of property rules there. And the property rule that says the railroad isn't liable for damage done by sparks is no more natural than the property rule that says it is, or the property rule that says the railroad is not permitted to throw sparks without permission from the farmer. That, after all, we think of the natural state of a legal system as I'm not entitled to murder you. And yet, you could argue, my throwing sparks that start fires in your fields, just like murder, is just a much smaller offense, but I'm violating your property rights. So there is no state of nature. And indeed, not only is there less of a state of nature than Pigou thinks, there's also less of a state of nature than modern sort of libertarian laissez-faire type people like me tend to think, in the sense that it's easy to say, well, it's obvious to my intuition what rights people have, and therefore taxation is wrong, you're taking stuff from me without my consent, therefore this, that, or the other thing. But then, as you look at this stuff more and more, you say, wait a minute, how do we know exactly what rights you have? It's my land, right? Does that mean I can prohibit overflights, that I can prohibit radio broadcasts? Probably not. Well, why not? How low do they have to fly? And how about draining out oil from under my land? How about slant drilling a oil well that actually reaches under my land? Again, it's just not clear how we figure out what part of the bundle of rights for land I got. And without that, the sort of intuitive strength of this regulation is wrong because it violates my rights gets weaker and weaker. And that's one reason why I would prefer to base my political arguments on these institutions make us better off rather than I've got certain gut level intuitions about rights, the feeling you shouldn't do this to me. But I can't support those in the sense in which I think I can support arguments which say if we have this legal rule, we're better off. So, but in any case, I think Coase is making an important and subtle point that you're going to have some framework of rights. And that, in fact, in the particular case Pigou was discussing, where it's, I think, quite obvious that Pigou never bothered to look at the legal history in question, he was just taking stylized facts which he supposed to be true, that in the particular case, not only was the railroad situation that Pigou complained about not the state of nature, it was the deliberate result of legislation. That under the existing common law in the 19th century, railroads were liable for throwing sparks, and it was only because the actual railroads that were built were generally railroads that were each individually authorized by an act of Parliament that they weren't liable. That in effect, Parliament had decided to intervene in the, quote, natural and the starting legal situation in order to make them not liable. And so Pigou has that backwards. But further, Coase says, Pigou is also wrong in saying that it was a bad idea, that it is entirely possible that for the railroads to not be liable is better than for them to be liable. And you would have to know the actual costs of preventing the problem by the two parties in order to figure out which one was better. Because, after all, if the transaction costs are low, we get the efficient outcome either way. If it seems more likely they're high, then liability for fires is good because it produces spark arresters, but it's bad because it prevents the switch to clover. Clover is my example, and his is just leaving the land uncultivated. All right? So Coase is really, in a sense, trashing Pigou on two different levels. One of them is on the historical and even conceptual level about the state of nature, but the other is just on the economics of how we ought to do it, and Coase is saying, no, you're thinking about the problem wrong. Everybody else is, too. That Pigou is sort of the accepted view, and we don't know in general if it's better or worse that way. So, Coase writes, a second feature of the usual treatment of the problems discussed in this article is that the analysis proceeds in terms of a comparison between a state of laissez-faire and some kind of ideal world. This approach inevitably leads to a looseness of thought, since the nature of the alternative being compared is never clear. In a state of laissez-faire, is there a monetary, a legal, or a political system? If so, what are they? In an ideal world, would there be a monetary illegal politicalism? If so, what would they be? Actually, very little analysis is required to show that an ideal world is better than a state of laissez-faire, unless the definitions of a state of laissez-faire and an ideal world happen to be the same. And in one sense, part of what Coase is doing here, which is really a sort of a broader issue than the particular things he's discussing, is critiquing what other people refer to as a Nirvana fallacy in economics as it was taught circa 1960. And what I mean by the Nirvana fallacy is the argument which says we can prove that in this situation the unregulated market will not produce the ideal outcome, that we can describe a better outcome than would be produced by the unregulated market. That's the form it usually took. Therefore, the government should intervene. And the fallacy is the assumption that government intervention will produce the ideal outcome. But the symmetrical approach to the question, in a sense, the approach which seems sort of logically to follow, is to say, all right, here is the outcome that will be provided without government intervention. What is the outcome that will be provided with government intervention? Without government intervention, there are problems coming from the fact that each person is interested only in his own interest and not in the general interest. With government intervention, there are problems that come from the fact that each player in the political system is interested in his own interest, not in the general interest. Without government intervention, there are problems due to maybe asymmetric information, public good problems, and so forth. But also with political intervention there is. So that, for example, the whole, what I think of as the high school civics class model of democracy, the idea that democracy works because if the government does the wrong thing, it'll be voted out, is torpedoed by the public good problem. The fact that the individual voter knows that investing time and effort finding out what the government is doing and whether it should be doing it is producing a public good for the whole society, that his vote is very unlikely to benefit him, it's unlikely to affect anything, and it affects anything that benefit is shared. So now Coase is saying that rather than comparing the outcome of laissez-faire to the outcome to the ideal, we ought to say, well, here are a variety of different ways we might organize society. What is our best estimate of the consequences of each? It might be that laissez-faire is best. It might be that some form of government intervention is best. But you can't answer that question just by showing that one of them is best not. And this is also connected with the issue of how the word efficient is used in economics, that pretty much most of the time in this class, what I'm really talking about is not, is arrangement A efficient, but is arrangement A more efficient than arrangement B? And I'm sure I slip up sometimes. And the reason is that when you use efficient as a binary category, as a yes, no, you're implying some absolute level of efficiency there that you do or don't achieve. And I think that may be a useful concept, but it has to be used carefully because it's unlikely that any institution will achieve it. So that elsewhere, in the book that he's been reading online of mine, I use the term a bureaucrat god. And what I mean by a bureaucrat god is an imaginary dictator who knows everything anybody in the society knows, has unlimited calculating ability to figure out how to coordinate people's actions, and can make people do whatever he pleases, and is benevolent. All right. And if you think of that as your benchmark, if you say, here is an arrangement, does it produce the same arrangement the bureaucrat god would? Does it produce the arrangement? Putting it differently, if I say this arrangement maximizes the size of the pie, that's a less well-defined concept than it seems, because any statement about maximizing is assuming some set of alternatives. All right. Well, we could certainly make the pie larger if we knew exactly how to construct thermonuclear power reactors, say. Maybe in 100 years we'll know that. Is our present arrangement inefficient because we don't tomorrow build them using the knowledge we're going to get in set three hands? It's a very odd way of putting it. And yet any statement about this could be improved has buried in it some kind of could. Yes?
To that point, if our current situation, though, makes it more difficult to use that technology in the future, that would presumably make it
and
less
you could,
efficient.
And
another alternative that maybe is less efficient now would be provide for a more efficient transition.
And you may ask the question, do we have the right incentives to generate the information? So that a sense of inefficient, which is less unreasonable than not knowing things we aren't going to know 100 years would be we have suboptimal incentives for people to figure out how to make thermonuclear reactors. Right? But all I'm saying is that any talk of this sort, somewhere buried in it, is an assumption of what you can vary. Is an assumption about... One, in a sense, somebody's line is, the optimist believes this is the best of all possible worlds. The pessimist says, I'm afraid you're right. Right? The optimist means by all possible worlds, all worlds I can imagine. What the pessimist means is, all the better worlds are impossible. That's why we don't have them. All right. Well, if you take that line far enough, if you take the sort of extreme determinist line, whatever outcome we have is efficient because obviously it can't be changed or it would have been. And so implicitly you're always thinking of some set of things that could be varied. So that if you imagine, is this the efficient organization for my small firm, I'm really thinking about, well, I could reorganize the firm in any of a bunch of ways. Is there any of those ways that would work better? If you say, is this an efficient legal system, you're somehow, it's fuzzier, but you're imagining yourself as a Supreme Court judge or a congressman and saying, all right, what changes in the law or changes in the precedents could we make within the range of ones we could make? Supreme Court justice doesn't have the option of ordering the ruler of Iran to do something. So it doesn't make sense. It's inefficient because if only the ruler of Iran would stop doing something we don't like, the world would be a better place. But the Supreme Court justice does have the ability to change liability law. There's enough of them to do. So anyway, all I'm really saying is that a lot of this talk about efficiency and improvement and such, not that it's wrong, but you have to remember that somewhere buried in that is some assumption about what are the variables that you can change. And typically in the law and econ literature, you're really saying among the legal systems we in some sense might have, given existing resources, technology and such, is there anyone that is better than this? So again, if you think about legal systems, you could arguably have a much better legal system if only we had really reliable lie detectors. And it is quite likely that it is possible if you only knew enough about the human brain to make a really reliable lie detector. But we don't know those things, and therefore it's not a useful criticism. Whereas it may be a useful criticism to say the way our rules are set up, people have incentives to tell lies, we could set it up so they don't have incentives to tell lies. Comments? Questions? All right. Anyway, let me go on to go through some more stuff, which is less fundamental but nonetheless useful. And this is just Coase's version of the railroad case, which is really logically like mine, though he's varying different things. One train produces $150, two trains produce $250. What does produce mean? He means the amount people would pay for tickets on the train or pay to ship their freight by the train is that total amount of money. That's the value of the services being provided. Each train costs $50 to run. What is that ultimately? That's the value of the inputs, the labor, steel, coal, and so forth, used to run each train. Consequently, from the railroad standpoint, it's making a net $100 if it runs one train, a net $150 if it runs two trains. All right, is that clear? Transaction costs are high, so we're not going to have bargaining between the farmers and the railroad. If the railroad is not liable, each train produces $60 worth of damage. Knowing that, it would be better not to have the second train because the second train is producing a net gain. Did I have it right? It was from 100 to 150, right? So the second train produces a net benefit of $50 at a cost to the farmers of $60, so better not to have the train. And the goo would stop there and say, clearly it's inefficient, therefore the railroad ought to be liable. And Coase would say, no. Therefore, given those facts, the railroad ought not to run the second train, but making the railroad liable will have a further effect. What is that further effect? the further effect is that the railroad is liable. The farmers will grow more grain in the on the land, the lawn, the railroad. That with the railroad not liable, if you'd actually looked there, you would have observed that for 100 feet on each side of the railroad line, there's grass, because it's not worth growing grain when it's going to burn down, and only beyond that is grain. Once we change the rule to make the railroad liable, now the farmers say, well, they want to burn our grain, we'll just send them the bill, and they plant right up to the railroad line. And you could imagine under those circumstances that the train is now producing $120 worth of damage for each train, and the result of that is that there are no trains at all in that hypothetical because the railroad is liable, and that's more than their profit from running the train. And you would then, Post says, you'd have to look at those two alternatives and say in each case when we allow for the cost of planting the crop and the value of the crop to the people who end up eating it, which of those two is better? All we know is both of them are worse, in my terminology, than what a bureaucrat God would give us. A bureaucrat God would say to the farmers, don't plant near the line and the railroad, only run one train. But neither rule gives us that ideal outcome, and so we've got to compare the actual outcome of the rules. All right? So that. Or to take Kosa's words, the question at issue is not whether it is desirable to run an additional train or a faster train or to install smoke-preventing devices. The question at issue is whether it is desirable to have a system in which the railroad has to compensate those who suffer damage from the fires which it causes, or one in which the railroad is not able to compensate. And that, as I say, in one sense, it's a very simple statement, but I think it is a profound critique of about 95% of what everybody says about political issues. Because everybody puts it in terms of the present arrangement is bad because it doesn't produce desirable outcome X, rather than the present situation is the present arrangement is bad because here is an alternative arrangement which would produce desirable outcome X without a more serious undesirable outcome Y. All right, and that it seems to me is what you see all the time. You know, when people talk about drunken driving or auto accidents or global warming or anything you can imagine, it's in the form of, if we do nothing about global warming, then the following undesirable consequences will occur, which is certainly worth knowing. It's relevant to the argument, but it doesn't end the question. You then have to say, it doesn't even end the question if you say, well, if we all reduce our output of carbon dioxide by such and such an amount, the cost to us of that reduction is $50 billion and the savings in damage of global warming is $100 billion. That still wouldn't answer the question, because you would say, well, how would you get us to reduce our carbon dioxide output? But you would have some set of rules. What consequences would those rules have? Maybe they would impose further costs of another $100 billion. You'd have to know. You'd have to look at it much more carefully. All right? So that's, I think, the logic of what he is saying, and I think it's right. And I think it's pretty clear if you read the thing carefully. On the one hand, Kosa's prejudices are for less government involvement and more laissez-faire. On the other hand, his scholarly claim is not that at all. His scholarly claim is, here is how you would figure out which of the two alternatives. Then you have to compare the alternatives, not just compare single outcomes. All right? And he then says, consider the case, and it's a case many of us have doubtless encountered, where you come to a stoplight in the middle of reasonably clear country, and the light is red, and it's 1 in the morning, and there's no traffic in either direction. Should you drive through it? Well, in one sense, the answer is, of course you should drive through it. Why should you waste a minute sitting still, running your engine at a stoplight? Then Coase says, well, maybe you should. Maybe that's a right answer to the question, what you should do. Should it be legal for you to do it? That's a very different question, because now if it's legal for you to do it, every case of somebody running a stoplight becomes not an argument about did you didn't run the stoplight, which is relatively easy to determine, but an argument about was it one of the cases where running the stoplight was a justified decision, much harder question to determine. All right? So should we conclude from this that the total product would be greater if there were no fines for failing to obey traffic signals? Coase is taking a more extreme case than I was. So he says, look, here is a case where the law against running the stoplight has a bad result. Somebody wastes some time in the middle of the night. Does that mean there should be no law against running a traffic light? No, it does not mean that. To find that out, you would have to ask whether on net abolishing the law would do more damage than. The Pigouvian analysis shows us that it is possible to conceive of better worlds than the one in which we live. But the problem is to devise practical arrangements which will correct defects in one part of the system without causing more serious harm in other parts. Comments? Questions? Anything else for any of you? One other point which Coase doesn't make, which people have made since this article was written, is that even though in a zero transaction world the outcome is always efficient, it's not always the same efficient outcome. And one way, there are a number of ways of looking at it. I'm running through one here. But before I go through this, consider that our definition of economic efficiency is measuring gains and losses to people by how much money they would pay to get or prevent them. All right? However, how much money I would pay to get or prevent something partly depends on how much money I have. That if I'm very wealthy, then avoiding having to sit in traffic for 10 minutes is worth many more dollars than if I'm very poor. But if we're considering different initial definitions of rights, one of the things those definitions affect is how rich and poor we are. That if the farmer has a right not to have his crops eaten, he is in effect richer than if he has to pay not to have his crops eaten by the animals. Different initial allocations of rights in general can lead to different outcomes being efficient, because an initial allocation of rights in which I'm right and I'm rich and you're poor is one in which it is efficient for a certain thing to go to me, because it's worth more dollars to me than to you, whereas if we reverse those assumptions, it would go the other way. In Coase's example, none of this comes up, because in Coase's example, all of the efficiencies are really coming from market prices. So in Coase's example, the farmer is not asking how much do I like grain or how much do I like beef. He's asking how much does grain sell on the marketplace for, and the rancher how much is beef. So the fact that one rule makes the rancher a little bit richer or the farmer a little bit richer isn't going to affect the market price of grain and beef, therefore won't affect what the efficient outcome is. But if you imagine, as I suggest I think here, if you imagine that for some reason all cattlemen are carnivores, they eat hardly anything but beef, and the reason farmers are farmers is that they are all Hindus who think that eating beef is sinful and therefore never touch beef, well, a legal rule that gave the right to the farmers would result in vegetarians being richer and carnivores being poorer. That would result in a higher market price for grain and a lower market price for beef, and that would result in a different optimal arrangement of the farmer and the rancher, because that's what they're ultimately trading off. So in principle, you could have, even if the zero transaction cost assumption of Coase held, you could still have different outcomes depending on your different initial definitions, but they'd all be efficient outcomes. They would just be efficient from different starting points. And the example that I used, I don't remember if I use it in this book, I probably do, but I've certainly used elsewhere, is the example where you have two people, each of whom has a pretty reasonable income, and you have one pill which will double your life expectancy. The Martians happened to leave it behind before they left, and they only left one of them because they wanted to see what we would do. And if the legal rule is the pill belongs to me, there is no offer you can make me up to your entire income for which I will sell the pill to you. That shows the pill is worth more to me than to you because I turned down your best offer. Therefore, it's efficient for me to consume the pill. But if the pill had started with you, there would have been no offer I could have made that would have made you sell it to me. Therefore, it would be efficient for it to stay with you. So that's a case where sort of much of the time in economics, we can ignore the fact that our efficiency is measuring dollar values, not utility values. But this is a case where that fact bites you and you've got to take account of it. Coase runs through a bunch of other interesting examples with similar logic. The confectioner doctor's example, which I think I may have discussed before, which is the one where you had a candy factory, which is obviously a virtuous and good thing, next to a physician, obviously a virtuous and good thing, and the candy factory's machinery vibrated the wall, and the physician built an extension onto his house with the result that now the vibration kept him from using the extension as a consulting room. And the question is, who has the right? Does the confectioner have the right to keep operating his machinery as he's operated in the past, or does the doctor have the right not to have his property on his land disturbed by the vibrations? And Another case that he discusses is one where you had some kind of effluent from a factory smokestack, where the effluent results in, apparently the only problem the effluent has is that people in the same area are bleaching coconut matting with a chemical process where the chemicals they use somehow combine with the gas that's coming out of the smokestacks, so that the bleaching doesn't work. I no longer remember the details. And that's sort of a nice case, because on the one hand, you can prevent the problem by not having the smokestacks emit whatever this is, but you can also prevent the problem by having the coconut bleaching facility move somewhere else, or by having them bleach with some different process that doesn't have the problem. There's a sort of a fun pair of cases which he discusses, and I don't remember seeing them when I was rereading the article.
I'm not sure if there's a longer version or if I saw them in something else he wrote, but they're an interesting case. Anyway, let me go over to this side. And it's two cases which in a way seem similar. First case goes as follows. I think maybe it should be a different article than those. We've got a building here and smoke coming out of the smokestack. Everybody's happy, no problem. There happens to be another building next to it. Is this one in this article or is it somewhere else? Yeah, I just noticed it rereading the article, but I'll go through it anyway. This is a good case. Everything is fine until the owner of this building decides to add a few stories to his building and then to stack some stuff up on top of it here. At which point, the wind that used to pleasantly blow through here and blow the smoke away and make the chimney draw now is blocked by the higher building, and the result is that this building tends to fill up with smoke because the chimney won't draw. Is there any legal liability? And one view is, I've been using the wind blowing across for the last 50 years. You're blocking it. You're imposing a cost on me. The other is, well, I'm just building on my own property. What do you think? That's one case. And the other case is the Jolly Anglers brewing case, and that's sort of a fun case. And that's one in which you've got somebody's courtyard here. And somewhere not far off, there is a brewery. And the brewery is operating in a basement. And the basement happens to be connected by an old, very, very ancient, disused mine, like from 2,000 years earlier or something, to the courtyard. And the ventilation of the brewery consists of the fumes from the brewery going up through this old mine and coming out of the courtyard. And at some point, the owner of the courtyard complains. You might think he liked having the smell of beer, but apparently didn't like the smell of beer. And the question is, can the brewery legitimately say, there's a legal doctrine which basically says, as I understand it, that if you have treated something as your property for long enough and nobody's objected, it's like adverse possession, but I think there's a different term that he used in the case. I think it's the doctrine of ancient rights or whatever. It's basically an adverse possession, only it's not adverse possession in this case of property. That then is assumed that legally is yours. And so the brewery says, look, we've been using this channel in order to ventilate our brewery for 150 years, however long the brewery has been there, therefore it's ours. And the owner of the courtyard says, no, you're making my courtyard less pleasant. Stop, I can block up your channel. And my memory is that the court held in this case for the brewery, not, of course, because beer is more important than anything else, but on the grounds, if I understood it correctly, that a confined channel by which air moved was capable of being owned. It was a and therefore, their use of that implied they owned it. Whereas in this case, they found against the homeowner here, or the owner of this building, and apparently, if I remember somewhere, Post's explanation of this, I'm not sure this is a longer version of the article that I read or something else that is, that the court in this case held that the unconfined channel there was not something capable of being owned, therefore the fact that he had been using it to blow away smoke didn't give him ownership of it, and therefore he had no claim against his house. So it's an interesting pair of cases, since it looked on the face of it like the same case, in which, in each case, something you don't want to have is getting blown away over someone else's property. And the question is, it sure looks as though he's deliberately blocking this van, his wife is building on his building, and yet the courts gave the opposite results. And it's unclear from the law and econ case whether you can really explain that result or if it's just a fact of what they did. So in the case of the draft of the chimney, of course, Coase's view would be, who caused the problem? Both of them caused the problem. There was no problem until he built this up, but there would be no problem if they didn't have a smokestack there. If they, and that if you have zero transaction cost bargaining, we're all right. If he's got the right, then he can still pay him for permission. If he has the right, he can still pay him to agree not to block his smokestack, not to build up his building. With transaction costs, you don't know a priori whether the cheapest way, after all, presumably one possibility is he could build his smokestack up even higher. Maybe that's the cheapest solution, you don't know. And, yeah, I don't remember where this is from, but it's
fairly stand. All of these are examples that Coase came up with, and part of what's fun about it, in a sense, is the degree to which Coase was actually looking at real law cases in order to get ideas on analyzing the logic of these problems. And, yes, I cannot resist this story. This is a story which I have heard told. I don't know if it's where it originates. I actually have heard it told as a Japanese wise, there's a whole genre of wise judge stories. And I've heard it as the Japanese one, but I then later came across, I think, a Renaissance Italian version of basically the same story. But the story is that there's a poor student, and all he can afford to eat is rice. But in order to make his rice at noontime more palatable, he sits next to the cook shop where they're baking meat and bread and stuff. And that way the smell of the good food adds to the pleasure of his rice. And at some point, the owner of the cook shop notices that the student is eating his rice next to the cook shop every day. He says, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, well, you know, the wonderful smells coming out of your cook shop make my lunch better. And the owner of the cook shop looks and says, you mean to say you're stealing my smells? You ought to pay me for those smells. And the student says, first, I'm a poor student. I can't pay you anything. But besides, why should I have to pay you for the smells? And so the cook shop owner goes to the judge and he says, I demand damage payments from the student for his misappropriating, for his stealing, without paying, without my permission, the good smells from my cook shop. And the judge says to the student, do you have any money? And the judge says, I have only 3 copper coins. And the judge says, give them to me. The student gives him the coins. And the judge pours the coins from one hand to the other, clink, clink, clink. From this hand back there, clink, clink, clink. And the cook shop owner is looking on, expecting to get the coins. And then the judge hands the coins back to the student. And the cook shop owner says, wait a minute, aren't those my payment? And the judge responds, the sound of the coins pays for the smell of the food. So we're used to thinking in terms of the kind of suit of lawsuit in which we use something like the Bagoovian approach for negative externalities. But the logic seems the same for positive externalities. If I'm benefiting you, I need to be paid for that benefit in order that I'll have the right incentive to produce it. And in fact, there are, and that, of course, is what the baker is asking for. And there are cases like that, and that the not very many, but the case that at least occurs to me is that if a physician sees somebody unconscious and injured and treats him, he's entitled to bill him for those services. So that's a case where you're doing it. And is Coase right? If the baker can't force the student to pay, but payment would result in the baker producing more savory smells in exchange, then bargaining would get the same result. In the doctor's case, of course, the argument for doing it the way we do it is precisely the fact that you can't bargain when you're unconscious, and that's part of why, I think if you think about the logic of that case, what differs that from somebody coming and cutting my lawn without my permission and then demanding payment is that it's a case where A, transaction costs are very high because one party's unconscious, and B, where we're quite sure that the unconscious, that it's an efficient action that the unconscious party would want to have his life saved by the physician, whereas we don't know whether I would want to have my lawn mowed. I once did have my lawn mowed, by the way, by my neighbors without my permission, I think as a protest about my not having mowed it for too long. Blacksburg, Virginia, and they also managed to mow down a newly planted small fruit tree, which they didn't notice because I let the grass grow so high. So I was sort of annoyed, but they had a point. And Coase mentions that, oddly enough, Pigou, discussing the smoking chimney, treats the pollution control as a positive externality rather than the pollution as a negative externality. It's really a symmetric case. You can think of it either way. And I have an extra R in there for some reason. How do we as law and econ people evaluate the judges deciding those two cases? One simple answer is, Coase says all you've got to do is define the rights, so we need some rule to define rights, and confined channel versus unconfined channel will do as well as any other. But another possibility, just as with coming to the nuisance, is maybe there really is a reason why one rule is better on average for confined channels and one for unconfined, and one possible one is that confined channels are fairly well defined, so easier to transact over, whereas who knows exactly where that air is blowing this way, this way, this way. You don't have a single thing you can think about buying or selling. So that's at least a possible explanation. Another solution to these problems, aside from either government regulation or contracting, is a firm. That if both activities belong to the same organization, it has an incentive to take account of the externalities both ways. And if you think about a shopping mall, Valley Fair, for example, that's quite a striking example of handling the problem in that way. So that one way of looking at Valley Fair is that it's the equivalent of a small town, only it's purely proprietary. It's not a political system at all. Somebody owns it. That somebody has an incentive not only to, you know, keep the place clean and nice and provide security, but also to say to himself, the clothing store would make more money if somewhere within 100 feet, either one direction or the other, there was a cookie store. Because people like, when they're buying clothing after they get tired of shopping for a while, to take a break and have a Mrs. Fields cookie. So therefore, I'll offer the site to a cookie store at a somewhat lower price than anybody else if I have to in order to get them. On the other hand, people who shop in this kind of place don't like seeing porn shops or something. I don't know what it would be. No need to have legal rules about porn shops. I just won't rent the property to a porn shop because the negative externality on my other tenants would be higher than the benefit to them they pay me for. So you can think of the shopping mall, the proprietary community, as sort of almost a mini dictatorial socialism, a mini version of Singapore, say. But it's within a competitive environment. If they don't on net produce benefits, they're going to go bankrupt. So they've got the right set of incentives to try to do it. And Coase has another famous article in the Theory of the Firm, which is making some of these points, and that whether it makes sense to solve the problem by putting the actors into one firm, again, depends on the trade-offs of the disadvantages of both systems. That the proprietor of the mall has to figure out how much the other people do or don't like porn shops or cookie shops or whatever, whereas on a market with bargaining, their values are reflected in their bargaining. On the other hand, transaction costs might be high if the cookie shop affects many stores, whereas the owner of the mall can take account of all of those. And government regulation is another solution with disadvantages and advantages. And a final solution is to do nothing, which is what we do for most small externalities. If transaction costs are high, court decisions matter, and in the limit of infinite transaction costs, we're in a Pigouvian world, except that Coase points out that we've got to figure out who to impose the cost on because there's still double-sided causation. He makes a bunch of other points. I'm running out of time. I spent more time on other things because I didn't realize how much more I had here. If factors of production are thought of as rights, it becomes easier to understand that the right to do something which has a harmful effect is also a factor of production. Just as we may use a piece of land in such a way as to prevent someone else from crossing it, we may use it in such a way as to deny him a view or quiet or unpolluted air. And then my favorite sentence, which I just happened to notice reading this, and which I think says something about the tone of voice Coase is writing on, is, "I will, although with reluctance, confine my discussion to rabbits." And he's talking about the body of English common law, which deals with wild animals versus domestic animals. Feri natura versus feri something or other. No. I mean, feri is wild, so it's something, it doesn't matter, but there's some technical term. But anyway, I thought that was a good line. And suggests what I think is true, that Ronald Coase does not take himself too seriously, which is a virtue, in my opinion, in a writer. So I think that covers